I work and get paid like minimum wage. Sights to hit the clock by the end of the day. Hop from downtown into the hood where I stay. The only place I can't afford cause my block ain't safe. I spend most of my time working trying to bring in...
Welcome to Off Kilter, the show about poverty, inequality, and everything they intersect with, powered by the Center for American Progress Action Fund. I'm Rebecca Vallis, and with Mercury still in retrograde, part two of Trump's budget is now out in the world, for better or maybe for worse. So we at Off Kilter are bringing in two of the budget gurus from the Center for American Progress, Seth Hanlon and Lily Roberts, to help me count down some of the most egregious proposals buried in Trump's cruel budget. But first, Chad Bolt. Chad.
Here I am.
Here you are. You are. You're here.
Back again.
What's going on with you?
Look, it's almost tax season. I mean, it is tax season, but the deadline's fast approaching. Have you done your taxes yet?
You are so on brand always. Can I just tell you that? Do you, serious question, do you have like an advent calendar that's a countdown to tax day?
Absolutely not. I don't know what would give you that suggestion about me, but I did do my taxes this past weekend, so that's why it's on my mind.
I so didn't.
Well, you know, you've got another couple weeks here.
I don't even want to talk about it. This is one of the things I'm worst at doing. But I am picturing you now with the advent calendar. And I sort of feel like as I was asking you that question, your eyes shifted like six times in mysterious ways that made me think.
Maybe I should have one.
Or maybe you do have one secretly and you've already like eaten all the chocolates out of it. And so like now you're very ready for tax day because there's no chocolate left in the advent calendar.
Okay, there's no truth to that. But I will say I was at home where I grew up in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania this weekend. And
I always forget that you grew up in Harrisburg.
Indeed.
Also known as H. Vegas.
Lovely. Is it? I've never heard that growing up in Harrisburg, but I did have...
People are saying, right?
Are they? I did have a lovely Central Pennsylvania spring tradition treat this weekend, which is chocolate peanut butter eggs.
Ooh. Oh, that sounds delicious.
Yes. They are amazing. I will bring some back for you next time I go home.
I was going to say, wait, you didn't bring them back for me? Is that the rest of that sentence?
I know. This actually turned into a terrible story because
I
didn't bring any to share with the class.
But Harrisburg, I mean, that makes sense because that's Hershey Land.
Mm-hmm.
So lots of chocolate out there.
Yes. Yeah. And it's like a big sort of like spring fundraiser thing that people do. They sell chocolate peanut butter eggs around Easter time.
Do you know a thing that people also do in Harrisburg?
Gosh, there's so many possibilities.
Also has to do with chocolate.
They go to Hershey Park?
They bathe in chocolate. Do you know that this is a thing you can do, like in the proximity of Hershey? You can actually go to spas that are like chocolate spas and submerge yourself in melted chocolate.
Yes, that I have heard. There are also the streetlights in Hershey are alternating wrapped and unwrapped Hershey Kisses.
Wait, really?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that.
Indeed. Yes, in downtown Hershey.
Well, that's cute.
Uh-huh.
All right. Well, yeah, next time you're going, I mean, take me, but also bring me back chocolate.
Will do.
So, Chad, we're supposed to actually talk about things that are going on in the world. And much as you're trying to make everything about tax season, I'm actually going to take us out of that for 1 week.
Sure, sure.
Because there are things that have been going on in Congress that we are overdue talking about, particularly because last week we focused entirely on week one of the budget,
yes.
You and me. One of those things has to do with paid leave. We've got Republicans. I'm actually taking a look first at sort of what's going on in Congress, even though we're actually in a recess week right now, but there's some stuff that people need to be aware of. A bunch of Republicans who are out there kind of saying that they've got this big, bold proposal on paid leave. What's going on there?
Yeah, so I think maybe I'll talk a little bit about what it is and then I think what I think it means. Senator Ernst and Senator Lee have a new bill that they introduced. Again, it is a fake paid leave proposal. And that is for a number of reasons. But what it boils down to is that this is a paid leave proposal that is only good for parents and children. And what it forces workers to do is choose between having paid leave now and their retirement security later. It essentially says, you need paid leave now, great. Just put off retirement later, put off collecting Social Security later, and you can have paid leave now. It is not helpful for workers to have to choose between paid leave and raiding their own Social Security.
And that's effectively what this bill would do. It's saying to current you, hey, how do you feel about screwing over future you? Oh, that sounds good. That's what this proposal would do.
Yep. That's exactly right. What I think it means, though, is that they have recognized that the appetite across the board for some kind of serious paid leave proposal is so strong, and that it's so popular and people really want this. They've realized that, okay, we need to put something out there, even if it's just a token gesture at trying to get at the policy problem people want Congress to tackle. And even if it's not really good for workers. I mean, this isn't. But we have reached the point in the conversation about paid leave where Republicans are acknowledging that, like, they need to come to the table with something. And of course, they've also done this with equal pay for equal work. They've got, sort of fake versions of that as well. But they realize that it is a popular enough idea, and that the moment is past due in trying to come up with some way to do it, that they're putting together these fake proposals to at least pretend that they're making an effort on it.
But the answer, of course, is not to let them get away with these fake proposals. It's to cut through them to see if what they're doing is putting forth good talking points that aren't backed up by good policy, because they realize that the public conscience is in a place where people are demanding these answers from people no matter which side of the aisle they happen to work on. Mm-hmm. We need to be pushing through and saying, does this actually meet basic tests? You're telling me this proposal absolutely doesn't, both based on whom it would help, who it would leave out, and who it would screw over if they took advantage of it.
Sure. I mean, there's the sort of consensus, or at least the very popular proposal from Democrats, which is the Family Act, and that bill works where employees and employers both make a small payroll contribution that goes into a fund administered by the federal government, and it's dispersed when workers are eligible and they need it. Because there's a dedicated stream through the employer and employee payroll contribution, it doesn't compete with other federal government priorities for funding. But it also, again, just to circle back, it doesn't force workers to choose between the leave they need now and the retirement security they need down the road. I mean, that's a low bar to hit, but, the Republican proposal doesn't cut it.
So another thing that happened last week in Congress that we didn't have a chance to talk about because of the structure of last week's show, but which is very much something that I think our listeners are going to care about, has to do with payday loans.
Yes.
And the fox who's guarding the henhouse these days over at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the CFPB.
Yep, that's right. Okay, so you might remember back at the beginning of this Congress, we were talking about the excitement around the boom House Financial Services Committee.
You were so excited that you got to say that in this episode again.
When I was typing up my notes, I was like, yes, we're talking about the Financial Services Committee.
The renamed Boom Financial Services Committee.
And we were really excited about the committee assignments because there were so many outstanding freshmen who were added, folks like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Ayanna Pressley. And this week in particular was Katie Porter. She made full use of her seat on the committee. So there was a hearing where the CFPB director, Kathy Craninger, was appearing. Remember, Kathy Craninger took over the CFPB from Mick Mulvaney. And she has no background in financial services or consumer protection.
And this much became extremely clear to anyone who saw the clip you're about to talk about.
That's right. So if you haven't seen the video, you should check it out. Basically, what happens is Katie Porter says, hey, I'll give you an example of a payday loan. She says, you might want to write this down. Here are the terms of the loan. Here's the origination fee. And can you, Kathy Craninger, calculate the APR for me?
So this is the person who is in charge of the entire federal agency that oversees consumer financial protection, right? That is her job.
Yes.
So if anyone in this country should know about payday loans and how they get calculated and what people end up owing on them, presumably it should be her. That's where you're going with this.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. And particularly because, like, she is the cop on the beat. She is the one leading the agency that is supposed to help consumers understand where they might fall prey to predatory practices in the financial services industry. And APR, which Katie Porter was asking about, is...
That's the interest rate.
Yes. And that is intended to help consumers understand, like, what's the bottom line? How much is this loan going to cost me to take out?
Right.
So Katie Porter says, like, here are the terms. Can you just calculate the APR for me? And Director Kraninger is like, well, like, this isn't a math problem. It's actually just a policy conversation. And Katie Porter is actually like, it is a math problem. And it happens to be a problem that traps people in a cycle of debt. That's why there's a whole campaign around this called the Stop the Debt Trap. That's true. There's 80% of payday loans, which are typically about 2 weeks, end with the borrower taking out another loan. So holding a copy of the textbook that Katie Porter wrote, she walks the director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau through how to calculate the APR on a payday loan.
And spoiler, it's like 400%.
Yeah. And in fact, in this example that Katie Porter was using, the APR was like 520%.
Jesus. And for a comparison, for anyone who's hearing that and going like, I don't know what that means. I mean, we're talking about an interest rate that blows out of the water almost any other kind of borrowing that people can do. If you think about credit cards, for example,
sure.
You're talking about like a 12 to 30% interest rate over the year.
That's exactly right. And so on average, these payday loans have a 400%. I mean, I think that is illustrative of just how predatory they are, especially because what it often ends with is the borrower just taking out another loan.
And another loan after that, and another loan after that.
Exactly. So following this questioning, Katie Porter said, like, hey, a lot of people were interested in how to get to the bottom of this math problem. And so on her Twitter feed, she, like, pulled out a whiteboard and said, like, here, like, let's everybody calculate this together. And in a way, like, that kind of, like, consumer education piece is the work that the CFPB should be carrying out.
And used to
consumers.
Carry out.
Indeed. But it's now being led by an official that couldn't give that simple whiteboard explanation of how it works.
Which maybe explains why she's totally down with rolling back really critical protections that would help people avoid being stuck in those kinds of debt traps and regulate the amount that payday lenders are able to charge. But maybe if she doesn't know the first thing about how they're taking advantage of low-income consumers, that could explain why she is totally fine sleeping at night knowing that her agency is in charge of actually screwing consumers over instead of protecting them.
That's exactly right.
So one other thing going on in Congress is something that we're going to talk about extensively next week, because get excited, we are scheduled for another Disability Justice Initiative takeover.
Hey-o!
I know I'm excited, and I know the Disability Justice Initiative folks are excited to come back in studio. We're going to be talking about a lot of things. One of those things is actually a piece of legislation that does have a Democrat on it. That Democrat is Kirsten Gillibrand, Senator from New York. Mm-hmm. And this is a piece of legislation that purports to address the opioid epidemic. But unfortunately, it includes in it, and folks may have been seeing on Twitter, some pretty significant blowback from the disability community, a specific time limit, like a number of days, I believe it's 7 days, that you're capped at getting opioids prescribed for you in an extremely overbroad way that will be massively devastating to countless people across this country who struggle to manage chronic pain. Mm-hmm. So lots that we'll talk about next week. But just wanted to note that, given that opioid bill is getting a lot of attention right now, hope that Senator Gillibrand's folks are listening, because we would love to talk with you about how we could fix that one particular provision of an otherwise important bill.
Absolutely.
So, Chad, we're actually in recess as we're having this conversation.
We are.
Your folks at Indivisible love recess.
Indeed.
You guys do a few things during recess times. What are the Indivisibles out there all talking about during this particular recess?
Yeah, so recess is one of the things that Indivisibles do best. Remember, recess is the period of time, it's officially called on the Hill the state work period. Which is exactly what it sounds like. They're supposed to be back at home in their state working, and the work they're doing is listening to you. It's part of the job. They are supposed to be back at home having town halls, meeting with their constituents, and indivisibles know how to take full advantage of recess. So we've got folks scheduling district office visits with their members of Congress. We've got folks going to town halls. We've got folks scheduling and holding empty chair town halls, which is essentially where indivisible groups put together a town hall for their member of Congress and say, like, don't even worry about it. We did all the planning for you. We got the venue. We got the microphones. We got the brownies.
It's not where Clint Eastwood shows up?
No, that's a different, that's different.
It's a different empty chair.
Yeah, that's a different empty chair. So they set everything up and they invite the member. And then of course, like, there are lots of members out there that don't like to face their constituents in this way because there's a lot maybe that they don't feel so good about what they're doing in D.C.
These are the people who, like Sean Spicer, like to hide in the bushes instead.
I completely forgot.
I don't know how you forgot about that one.
Sean Spicer hiding in the bushes.
Dude, like literally, when anyone ever says the name Sean Spicer, I just automatically picture like a man hiding in the bushes. And like the way I picture it too, it has like one of those silly costume pieces that you see in like bad movies where someone like is dressed like a bush. And so they have like a headpiece on that has like a bush coming off of their head also. Like, that's what I picture, just to be clear. But I'm sorry, you were talking about recess.
Indeed. I mean, like, this is, you know, in 2017, when Indivisible was still first getting off the ground, like, that's actually not far off from what we saw over recess. And I'm thinking of Mike Kaufman fleeing out the back door of a library so that he didn't have to face his constituents who were at the front door.
Because this was during the healthcare fight and people were mad.
That's right. That's right. And so we are sort of back to our roots. You know, recess is the period of time where members of Congress are back on your home turf. So you should be able to find them somewhere in the district and ask them the tough questions. The opportunity that we have now with Democrats in charge of the House is to go on offense a little bit. You know, for the first 2 years of the Trump administration, we obviously had no agenda setting power. We were in total reactive defensive mode. But now we can expect more out of the House. We've got agenda setting power. And so they should be using that opportunity to pass bold, progressive legislation.
So what are you hearing your folks asking for in this kind of a recess period?
Yep. So one thing that we know is going to come up we expect will come up for a vote next week is the Paycheck Fairness Act.
Yay!
Yeah, we've talked about this before on this show. This is about equal pay for equal work. And you might say, like, hey, don't we already have that? And the answer is we do have the Equal Pay Act, but it's got a number of loopholes. Congress passed the Lilly Ledbetter Act in 2009, which extended the statute of limitations to bring cases under the Equal Pay Act. But because it's still got those loopholes, we need the Paycheck Fairness Act to close them and really get at the root causes that fuel the gender wage gap. And so we expect it to get a vote next week. In the House. And one thing that we've noticed in this Congress is that Republicans have gotten very good at using a procedural trick called the motion to recommit.
Oh, yeah. Explain this. The MTR.
Yep. So this is, it's kind of like the last chance for Republicans to amend the bill before it is voted on a final time and passed. And like I said, they're really good at using this trick. And essentially what it does is weaken the bill in some way. They've already used it, for example, on the Yemen resolution that went through the House. They tried to use it on HR1. And it's always some like last minute gotcha kind of trick that is intended to divide the Democratic caucus and like cause them political problems down the road.
So the entire point of it is just to force a vote on something that they think will be painful for Democrats and divide the caucus.
Yep, that's exactly right. It's nothing but a procedural trick that Democrats should just reject. They don't have to give thoughtful consideration to the like policy merits of these political games Republicans are playing. They can just reject them. In fact, not a single Democratic motion to recommit was successful 2011 to 2018. and so they MTR should get the exact same treatment this time around. So
you mean we hold ourselves to different standards, Chad, as Democrats? Is that what you're saying? Do you mean that we play by different rules?
I know.
I find this extremely hard to believe.
Well, believe it, Rebecca.
But you were going to explain why you were telling people what MTRs
so,
are.
So, well, we actually, and like I said, these are like last minute things. It always causes a little bit of chaos on the House floor as folks figure out what to do. And like I said, they can sort of alleviate the last minuteness of it by just always opposing the MTR as a political trick. And so we don't know yet exactly what kind of last minute MTR the Republicans are going to offer on paycheck fairness. But what we can reasonably expect is that it will weaken the bill in some way. It will make it worse. And so Democrats they've got the votes to pass paycheck fairness. In fact, every one of them is co-sponsoring it. So they just need to say no to the MTR. So that's the one of the most strategic things. It's going to be coming up right after recess is over that folks can be talking to their member of Congress about.
I'd say if you're gonna try to envision a whip count that's like pretty solid for passing a bill, every single member of the caucus being a co-sponsor of the bill, I'd say that's a solid whip count.
You can be fairly confident, but see, that's the thing. So far, what's happened this Congress is that Democrats have indulged the MTR. In fact, like on the Yemen resolution, enough Democrats voted for the MTR that it changed the text of the resolution. And of course, it had already passed the Senate, which just meant that like now the House has to like pass it again. It messed the whole thing up passing the Yemen resolution. And so, like I said, it's about Republicans playing political games. And Democrats they're all co-sponsoring this bill. They should not indulge any effort to weaken it at this point, given that it's so close to the finish line. So we've got paycheck fairness. We've got indivisibles out there talking about Medicare for All, Green New Deal, the Dream and Promise Act, which is really important. We've got indivisibles whose members of Congress are on the Appropriations Committee. We're at the very beginning of that fight over trying to cut the budgets and hold the Trump administration accountable for his spending with Customs and Border Patrol and Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE and CBP.
And boy, is that the other side of the budget conversation, right? Which we're talking about lots more later on in the show to continue our part one from last week. But that's a very real live set of fights that people are going to need to watch closely and that we'll be following here.
Yep, indeed. And the thing to know about that is like, you know, we'll likely have another sort of end of year government funding showdown in December, but that will be the end of the fight. The beginning of it is right now.
Don't go away. More Off Kilter after the break. I'm Rebecca Vallis.
You've got us 24 hours a day on your mobile smartphone via the Progressive Voices app. This is the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn.
So I want to take us to the states because there's a ton going on in the states right now. Some of it's good, some of it's bad. People probably can guess that the third word I'm going to choose is ugly, right? Because don't we always use that phrase? But over in the states, I mean, one of the things that I feel like we sort of have to start with here, and now as we're taping, finally, mainstream media, and including national outlets like the New York Times, Washington Post, et cetera, have finally started to cover this story. But one of the biggest stories happening in the past week has, of course, been the historic and tragic flooding taking place across the Midwest. Estimates are starting to put the damage in terms of lost and dead livestock and lost farm equipment and productivity and damaged land. I mean, we're talking about like $1 trillion from just some of these extremely early estimates. Those numbers are only going to continue to climb. And we're seeing pictures come out of Nebraska and Iowa and South Dakota. I was just looking at some of the pictures from Nebraska before we started rolling tape. And I mean, it's like not just tragic. It's like images that will stick with you forever if you actually look at them. Baby calves floating by the dozens down through toxic, polluted water. And farmers are having to go in and pull these dead baby calves out of the water. I mean, it just like really, really horrific stuff. And of course, you know, I'm describing sort of the image here and some of the dollar figures, but the lasting story here gels with one of the conversations we've been having on a regular basis on this show, which is the effect it's going to take on the already disastrous farm crisis that this country is facing. One statistic to remind people of: farm filings for bankruptcy just last year, across the Midwest rose by 19%. That's the highest level they've been at in a decade, according to the American Farm Bureau. And now many of those same farmers have lost their livestock and their livelihoods in the process. And yet, especially as we're in a period of talking about this administration's priorities and its budgets, just a little periodic friendly reminder that the Trump administration has repeatedly called for cutting disaster recovery funds and diverting that money to its deportation force and other types of purposes that are, of course, intentionally divide and conquer and about throwing red meat to the base, but which are absolutely devastating to the very people that Trump campaigned on promising to help. There's probably nobody who more represents the forgotten man and forgotten woman or the Trump voter than the faces of these farmers out there in the Midwest who are now losing everything with very little attention being paid on the coasts. So wanted to give a little bit of voice to what's going on in the Midwest. And we'll come back to that as we continue our series, our periodic series on this show about the farm crisis. Mm-hmm. Chad, I want to move to good news for a second because that is a particularly bleak story. And good news coming out of our own backyard here in D.C. when it comes to childcare.
Yes, that's right. So there is a new proposal from the D.C. Council to cap childcare costs at 10% of income.
Woohoo!
So that's great news. We know it is an increasingly large, huge problem. In 2016, in fact, one study shows nearly 2 million parents reported having to turn down a job, quit a job, or significantly change their job because of childcare issues. Childcare costs, at this point, it costs more than public colleges in many cases. So this is a welcome proposal out of the D.C. Council.
Wonderful to see that, and particularly enjoying seeing state and local action on this issue when so much of the national debate has been around childcare, and deservedly so. There's a ton that states and cities can do. So kudos to D.C. for doing something right here, and excited to see other folks follow suit. Now, flipping back to bad news for a second, we got some bad news coming out of Florida, and that is where that state's legislature, of course, folks remember just a few months ago, lots of excitement coming out of Florida when it came to Amendment 4, restored the right to vote to more than a million voters in that state. I believe it's 1.4 million people who got the vote to write back the right. I can't. The vote to write. I'm struggling with Mercury, man. Mercury's got to get out of retrograde. Okay. All right.
Oh, is that what it is?
For like another week.
Oh, gosh.
And a half. It's been going on for like 2 weeks.
Is it always that long?
No. If you've been feeling foggy ever at all, if any of your tendencies that you consider to be your worst tendencies have been even worse right now, I am telling you, and I'm not joking, it is Mercury in retrograde.
Wow.
This is a universal experience.
See, what if I like my worst tendencies? Then I'm just like, right now it's just like awesome time for me.
What if I like my worst tendencies? Then I'd say that you're making poor decisions about how to live otherwise, because just be you. I don't know. Okay. One more time. Now, flipping back to bad news for a second, we've got some unfortunate news coming out of Florida's legislature. Folks will, of course, remember Amendment 4. So much excitement coming out of that state after the ballot measure passed overwhelmingly last November to restore the right to vote in that state to 1.4 million people who had it taken away from them because of criminal convictions. Huge success measure that's been pointed to as one of the largest, if not the largest, reenfranchisement in our nation's history. And yet now we've got the Florida legislature moving forward a proposal that would strip Floridians of the right to vote if they haven't yet been able to fully pay court fees and fines, the kind of Ferguson-styled nickel and dime stuff that states across this country all, and Florida is no exception, engage in to try to get blood from a stone and extract revenue from black and brown low-income folks, by and large. So this is such an incredibly disappointing piece of legislation to see this legislature moving forward, considering that it would be one of the ways to pull the thread and cause the entire blanket to unravel of this tremendous re-enfranchisement success that we saw in November. So definitely one to watch, and hopefully one to be able to celebrate its defeat.
And it is not unlike what Republican officials in other states have done when states have expanded Medicaid by ballot measure. We've seen Republican governors and legislatures try and step in and reverse the Medicaid expansion in a similar way, overruling the will of voters. Same case here.
And that one happens to be maybe a little more full, kind of like a frontal attack on a success. Mm-hmm. This might be like a side door or a back door, but it is going to have exactly the same effect, given how widespread these kinds of fines and fees can be. And we could be talking about people who are not getting their right to vote back because they owe $500, $1,000, really small amounts of money, relatively speaking, that a lot of people could argue maybe they should never have owed in the first place, considering what the basis for a lot of these fees are.
Yes.
But in ways that could prevent people from participating in society and getting their right to vote back, all because we've got lawmakers who would like to see that not take effect and have found a creative way to do that. So something to watch, and we'll definitely check back in on that one in the weeks ahead. But we've got good news on the flip side, also in the criminal justice space,
yes,
coming out of California.
Yeah, so Governor Gavin Newsom ordered a halt to the death penalty.
Woo-hoo!
In California.
Yes.
This is a big, big victory for anyone who is interested in a more just criminal justice system. For every 9 people executed in this country, 1 person is exonerated. I think that probably says all that needs to be said about continuation of the death penalty and why that's a bad idea. And so kudos to Governor Newsom for taking this step.
Huge deal. Just a lot of applause to offer to Governor Newsom for this one. And that statistic that you just mentioned, Brian Stevenson, who runs the Equal Justice Institute, and it is one of the most vocal opponents of the death penalty in the United States, he often makes the point that when you think about stats like that, for every 9 people executed, 1 person has been found to not guilty and wrongfully convicted and wrongfully exonerated. I mean, think about those numbers. If we were having any other policy conversation, and this is a point he often makes, if we were talking about, say, aviation safety, right? And for every 9 flights that land safely, 1 flight goes down in flames and all the passengers die, we wouldn't have air travel, right? Without major changes to that structure and that system. And yet that isn't the conversation we're having in this country when it comes to executing our fellow citizens and not being entirely sure whether they actually did it, because that's what that statistic bears out.
Yeah.
So
good for California.
So good for California. And boy, is that something we need to see nationwide. We had more good news coming out of the states on the criminal justice front as well. And so I want to leave this with a good news place, which is one that is extremely close to my heart. And that is that this clean slate automated record clearing movement that we've continued to watch take state by state by state into the mix, following in the footsteps after Pennsylvania became the first state last year to adopt this model.
My home state.
You're back to full circle. We're back to Harrisburg, where it all began. And so last year, we had Governor Wolf join forces with a Republican-controlled legislature, as well as advocates from pretty much everywhere in the political spectrum, and even some NFL players like Malcolm Jenkins and other people who, you know, play for your Eagles.
Eagles.
You're welcome that I gave you a chance to do any of that. I mean, I could sing Fly Eagles Fly with you if you wanted. I don't do the chanting.
All right, we'll put that in the nerdy syllabus.
Yeah, the chant or the song or
the
what?
Fight song.
The fight song. Yeah. We'll put this on. Okay. So leaving things there in terms of good news from the states, we would be remiss if we did not close with a factoid of the week, Chad, right?
It's my favorite way to close.
It's my favorite way to do anything, right?
Absolutely.
Is with factoids.
With factoids.
Especially when they come from the great Rachel West, who is unfortunately, I hate to have to share this news with listeners, no longer one of my delightful colleagues at the Center for American Progress, because she has sadly left CAP to be wooed successfully over to the Hill, where she was scooped up to go be an economist with the House Ed and Labor Committee. Really excited for her. Already miss her.
Yep, miss you, Rachel, but congratulations. I'm very excited for you.
And looking forward to working with her in that new role, of course. But you know what? We still have a Rachel West factoid of the week, right? Because of course we do.
The Rachel West factoids persist.
The Rachel West factoids live on. And this one in this particular week has to do with SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. Folks will remember that this particular program is not just part of Trump's proposed Cruelty Olympics budgets cuts. It is definitely part of that. And we talk about that a little bit more in the next segment of this episode. But folks will remember there's a specific proposal. We've talked about this like a broken record almost every week because it is so important and such a risk. There is a specific proposal that Trump is trying to sidestep Congress mm-hmm. to move forward and actually just enact by fiat. It would take, as folks will remember, food away from upwards of 750,000 Americans if it takes effect. Those are people who are unemployed or struggling to find work. And so Rachel, in her factoidy ways, did a little bit of number crunching to answer the question, what would happen if this took effect? Not just in terms of how many people would become hungry as a result or would lose food assistance. She asked the question, what would happen if this proposal took effect? What would happen to the economy? What would happen to jobs? You know how Republicans always love to say, oh man, raising the minimum wage, that's a job killer. Yeah. Well, we know that that's mostly a myth. But if you actually look at cuts to a program like SNAP, that is really a job killer. And her analysis found to the tune of 179,000 jobs that would be killed just over the next decade yeah. if this rule, just this one single proposed cut to SNAP, were to take effect.
Yeah. I mean, compare the economic effects of, say, oh, I don't know, tax cuts going to the wealthy, where maybe they spend it, but maybe they don't, and maybe they instead pass it tax-free to their heirs, versus the government spending in the form of SNAP, where the vast majority of SNAP benefits are spent at supermarkets and grocery stores in the first 2 weeks. That has a direct economic effect and fuels the factoid that Rachel found this week. A 2015 study found that during the Great Recession, expanding SNAP was actually one of the most effective forms of stimulus that the government undertook on a dollar-to-dollar basis, which just underscores why this is such an important program. And Trump's attempt to go around Congress, I mean, by the way, when Republicans controlled the House and the Senate, they rejected this. They passed a farm bill without this in it. And so this is now Trump's attempt to go around Congress and just do it on his own. Which obviously is a huge problem.
And basically what this finds is it would be a double whammy. It would hurt 750,000, maybe more, according to an analysis from Mathematica, which makes us think that maybe it's like 1 million people or more. That number continues to climb every time smart economists look at it. But not only would it take food away from scores of people, it would also hurt the economy. It would also take a significant toll on the economy, and in the form, including in the form of lost jobs. Yes. And that's a hell of a double whammy when you think about it, considering that we would be taking jobs away from people, and then also when they're unemployed, not having food stamps for them anymore because of how the rule would operate. So hell of an insult to injury there.
It is a lose-lose. It's hard to imagine the Trump administration coming out and pursuing so heavily a proposal that's so bad, and yet here we are.
Handsoffsnap.org, of course, is where you can go to brush up on what's going on there. And before April 2nd, which is the date we keep repeating because it is so important that everyone submit public comments, handsoffsnap.org has a handy comment tool to check out and use. And, you know, a little shameless plug, share it with your friends. Share it with your family.
I wouldn't even call it a shameless plug. I think this is so important. I'll call that a humble plug.
Ooh, a humble plug.
Humble plug.
Okay. And I'm going to challenge our listeners to send handsoffsnap.org to 3 friends or family members that have not yet submitted comments, because we are mighty and we are many when we all submit comments.
Indeed.
Just like the old saying goes.
Is that how it went?
No, there's no saying. There should be no saying that sounds like that, because that was like, you know, like it was important, but it wasn't particularly well said.
Those are always the best kinds of sayings.
We're just going to keep talking, Chad. Will, what do you think? Should we just keep talking?
will get us to the end of this
episode. This episode has been.
Don't go away. More Off Kilter after the break. I'm Rebecca Vallis.
Hi, I'm Gianna Garrel from Progressive Voices. Today, the angry roar of the conservative media machine dominates TV and radio, threatening to drown out and push out anyone who dares to discuss our progressive perspectives and ideals. But we can't let that happen. We have too many strong, smart, and important progressive voices who need to be heard. That's why here at PV, we're building a 21st century progressive media universe. One where all the best in progressive media can come together, rise above the static and the noise, and be heard by anyone, anywhere. And we need your help. We're in the middle of a critical campaign to make our dream of 21st century progressive media universe a reality. But we can't do it without grassroots support from people like you. Head over to progressivevoices.com to see how you can help. Please support this important progressive mission, because with your help, we can make sure all our progressive voices are heard.
You're listening to Off Kilter. I'm Rebecca Vallis. And with me to unpack what is in this second round of this year's Cruelty Olympics is Lily Roberts. She's the Director of Economic Mobility at the Center for American Progress, making her Off Kilter debut. Lily, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Seth Hanlon, who's a friend of the show, one of our tax gurus, a senior fellow in things at CAP. Seth Hanlon. Seth, thanks for coming back.
Good to be here.
So, guys, I feel like maybe I should once in a while come up with, like, you know, really sunny, rosy topics to have you on about. Seth, every time I have you on, it's doom and gloom of some kind. So, you know, apologies. Sorry, not sorry, I guess. But I really appreciate you guys making time, because we are now in week two of a grueling two-week period during which many of us have all been scrutinizing various PDF documents and tweets and other sources of information about what is in this Trump budget. Before we get into what's in this second round and what's new that we've learned, would love to sort of remind people a little bit of why we're in this two-week place, and how that is not an accident and is actually very intentional on the part of the Trump administration. We talked a little bit last week about this, but it's no accident that they're putting out this budget in two parts. A big part of that is to hide the cuts that Trump knows are deeply unpopular and that they've been getting hit on every single time they come out with a budget. But that's now what has us in a place of being able to react with a lot more information this week than we had last week about what the details tell us about what these cuts are and who's going to get hurt. All that being said, I feel like there's been a lot of budget analysis already at this point. And so, dear listeners, we've decided to do this a little bit differently than some other segments out there looking at the budget. And we've decided, instead of giving you the everything that's in it complete look, we're going to zero in on the top five most egregious things in this budget. And that's what you guys came ready to do. So, Seth, I think you're kicking us off with number five, excellent. And it has to do with tax cuts. My right, God, the thought.
Drum roll, please. Well, of course, you know, the budget, of course, is the statement of the president's priorities, and so it wouldn't be complete without more tax cuts for the rich. And so, of course, you know, there are about $1 trillion of additional tax cuts that are skewed to the rich here in this budget, right?
This is additional tax cuts.
This is additional tax cuts. So, on top of the $2 trillion, or almost $2 trillion of tax cuts that were enacted at the end of 2017. So President Trump's now proposing, you know, to make those tax cuts permanent, including, you know, a number of the tax cuts that benefit him and people like him in particular. So the cutting of the estate tax, the special new deduction that we like to call the Trump deduction for owners of business entities like partnerships and LLCs, that effectively lowers his tax rates, and then also just the lower rates for people at the top. So the new tax cuts are cost an additional $1 trillion. So
on top of the $2 trillion that they've already added to the deficit through the 2017 round?
Right. Exactly. And I think, you know, there's, you know, sort of buried in this budget. So first of all, they put the tax cuts in their baseline. So they sort of sneak in these tax cuts. They sort of smuggle them in through customs instead of, you know, having an actual line in the budget proposal for we would like $1 trillion of additional tax cuts skewed to, you know, wealthy people.
You said they smuggle them in through customs?
Yeah.
That's sort of an interesting metaphor to choose considering this budget and this administration.
Well, that is true.
But I'll take it.
Right. Right. Yeah, the wall's not going to be effective in it now. So, but it's an additional $1 trillion. And so I think there's a kind of tacit admission in this budget that the first round of tax cuts aren't going to have the kind of incredible magical effects that they promised them to have. So of course, when, you know, 2 years ago when they were proposing these tax cuts, they said the tax cuts would spark an incredible boom of economic growth, that it would permanently raise the growth rate of the United States to about 3%. And now 2 years later, the Fed chairman actually just came out today, said they're projecting growth, you know, 2 years, and it's sort of back to the same growth trajectory that it that we'd had before. So in other words, the tax cuts haven't, you know, are not creating the kind of long-term growth that they promised. But then, of course, you know, what they're saying now is that, well, if you just give us more tax cuts, then we can, you know, make good on all the promises that we made a couple of years ago.
And all of this in the same budget that has all of this rhetoric throughout it about the deficit. Mm-hmm. And oh my God, the deficit, and it's rising, and we have to find places to cut. And yet they still find more room for tax cuts for the wealthy.
Yep. About $1 trillion worth.
And Seth, I feel like it's also worth maybe reminding people what we know about the growth rates, as you were just kind of describing mm-hmm. them. Why don't you unpack that a little bit, make it English, because this actually cuts to the heart of a lot of the trickery in this budget that's on top of all of the cruel cuts we're going to get to in a second.
Right. I mean, so I think the bottom line here, you know, in the short story is that. The Trump administration is covering up the cost of the tax cuts. Like, at the crux of this budget, what it is they've given away $2 trillion of tax cuts and are asking for an additional $1 trillion more. And they're paying for it on the backs of working people and low-income people in this country through cuts in health care and nutrition and education and lots of other things that we'll talk about. But they can't just come out and say that, right? Like, they can't just come out and say, here's how we're paying for our tax cuts. So the fiction that they invented, you know, and this isn't new to the Trump administration, but of course it's like, you know, voodoo economics that goes back decades, is that the tax cuts are going to magically pay for themselves. And so they promised, you know, a couple of years ago that the tax cuts would sort of raise the growth rate of the United States from a long-term trajectory, which basically all mainstream economists, public and private, the Federal Reserve, the Congressional Budget Office, the blue chip forecasters, think that the economy is going to grow at about 2% a year. Now, of course, they could be wrong. Like, that's a projection, right? But that is the best evidence that we have so far. And the Trump administration, based on no evidence at all, claimed that their tax cuts would magically boost growth to about 3% a year permanently, and therefore pay for themselves. And no serious economist, you know, takes this stuff seriously. And it's just the sort of fiction that their tax cut and the strategy behind the tax cut was based on. So now they come back a couple of years later, and of course, we're looking at the same, you know, projected growth rates, and growth slowing in the U.S. this year. But of course, you know, they have to pretend that, like, they're fulfilling those promises.
So they just go in with, like, an eraser, erase two, put in three, and they're mm-hmm. like, wait, now the math works. This is great. That's basically what you're saying happened?
Basically. And so, you know, so I think, you know, they sort of, basically, you know, none of the overall numbers in this budget. I mean, this is, I think, not terribly shocking to people 2 years into the Trump administration. But, you know, just like you can't believe anything they say about anything, the numbers in this budget simply can't be trusted. And so they say that they're, you know, restraining, but they say that the cuts in the budget to healthcare and education and other programs are necessary to reduce deficits. But what's really going on is that they're paying for the tax cuts.
And while they dole further tax cuts out, or at least say that that's what they would want to do if they could.
Right, of course.
So, Lily, I want to go to you next with this next one, which is there's a lot of bait and switching going on. Have you noticed this?
Yeah, I mean, so we've got this, you know, 2 months ago, we had the president giving the State of the Union, which is the, you know, annual speech where he lays out his priorities. And we got these some pretty grand goals that, you know, I think some folks would agree with. You know, we had some goals around eradicating pediatric cancer. That was a really big part of the speech.
Big applause line.
Yeah, exactly. One of the guests the first lady brought was a child with cancer. You know, I think we're all for getting rid of pediatric cancer. The announcement was that they were going to allocate $500 million over 10 years to solve the problem of pediatric cancer, which if you, you know, parcel that out, that's $50 million a year. In the context of the NIH budget, that which is $39 billion with a B.
NIH being the National Institutes of Health.
Yeah. I mean, $50 million a year is very little. It's a drop in the bucket of $39 billion. And then on top of that, they proposed to cut that budget in this, they proposed to cut the NIH in this budget by $5 billion. So they've got this idea that they're going to give a tiny new chunk of money to eradicate pediatric cancer, but actually what they're going to do overall is reduce staffing and take away grant programs to scientists and all kinds of things that are very likely to have impact when it comes to solving pediatric cancer. It's not just the cancer world. I mean, they talked about, the president talked about eradicating HIV in the State of the Union. And, you know, again, if we go through these healthcare cuts, Medicaid, Medicare, like, you know, if you take away people's healthcare, they are very likely to, you know, not be able to access medication or treatment for HIV. So there's no way to eradicate HIV that doesn't include expanding healthcare. And instead, what they're saying is we're going to take healthcare away.
His budget also, I mean, it, doesn't it cut the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, by like a third? If we're talking about huge cuts to agencies that are relevant in these spaces?
Absolutely. And there are like other science agencies as well. The National Science Foundation, you know, offices where they are making grants to researchers. You know, there's a ton of, you know, both biology, medicine, and then other kinds of science that are just totally gutted by this budget.
So they wanted the talking point about kids with cancer, which, of course, makes sense. And everyone was happy to clap for. But when you actually look at it, basically what I'm hearing is it's one step forward, a million steps back.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think that, like, it's easy to talk about science in the context of healthcare. But science also, you know, science research that the federal government supports leads to a ton of economic growth, too. So it's just a bad economic decision to take away funding for, you know, the federal government did the research that invented the internet and iPhone screens. Like, those are things that have that are huge engines within the economy. So not only are you really under-supporting healthcare research, but you're taking away research support for all these other agencies as well.
While you're saying that, I'm sort of looking at my sad iPhone with all of its cracks in its screen, and I'm like, man, I haven't been very nice to this research that, that produced this, but point well taken. And if you're keeping with that bait and switch theme, I mean, boy, is there so much more going on, right, when you think about things that he has promised as recently as the State of the Union just a few weeks ago, even though it feels like we've lived a lot of lives since then. And then you actually look at the budget, which is where the rubber meets the road. Infrastructure is hugely in that category, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's eternally Infrastructure Week.
And it's always. By the way, happy Infrastructure Week. I forgot to tell you that when you came into the studio.
Thank you. I should get a card. Like, they should make cards for that now at, like, CBS that you can just pick up.
We should, actually, and get those for Kevin DeGood, Cap's yeah. Infrastructure Guru. Yeah. Note to self,
yeah,
pick those up.
Yeah, just hand him a new one every week. Yeah, I mean, infrastructure. So part of this sort of plays into this two-part budget idea where last week we got some of the top line stuff and we got a lot of the narrative that was coming out of the administration. And then this week is when we actually found out how they were going to make things happen. So last week we got this highlight about $200 billion in increases for infrastructure. And then this week we read that there's $286 billion cut just in transportation. So it's like, well, what is infrastructure? Like, how on earth are you making infrastructure happen if what you're actually doing is cutting the programs that are these ongoing ways to improve infrastructure around the country?
Seth, you look like you were going to say something there.
I mean, just that this is like a fundamental con, right? I mean, this is like so characteristic of Donald Trump, right? To like, you know, this is like just Trump University. This is like the Trump University budget, right? To promise $50 million, you know, in pediatric cancer research, and then take away $4.5 billion, right?
It's a Ponzi scheme
of the overall budget, right? Yeah, it's an absolute. It's like the it's just the types of budget tricks that you would expect from a con man.
Well said. So another category of just egregiousness in this budget is just outright eliminations of programs that many of which actually contribute to the survival of humans who otherwise might not survive without some of the assistance provided by some of the programs that this budget zeroes out. One of the documents that that you guys and I and other people at CAP and other places have all been nerding out with and referring to has like one of the most Orwellian names. It is so when you look at these budget documents, for any of you listeners who have not been doing this, and boy do I envy your life in a lot of respects if that is the case. The budget this year is titled A Budget for a Better America. It has a little tagline: promises kept, taxpayers first. I mean, it's almost like the Onion came up with the branding here, right? Because of just how absolute bullshit so much of this is on its face. But this document I'm referring to that has all of some of the scariest stuff in it, it's called Major Savings and Reforms. Everyone's sending it around being like, have you looked at the MSAR, right? So just giving folks a little glimpse into the nerd life for people who spend time with these budget docs. But when you look at this Major Savings and Reforms document, it's basically a hit list, right, of all the critical programs that this administration wants to either deeply slash or outright eliminate. What are some of these programs that they just totally want to zero out?
Well, so there are a bunch sort of in, you know, you talked about supporting sort of like the basic living standards, and we have a bunch, you know, Meals on Wheels programs that support low income and elderly people who need help with utilities or heat in their house. These programs that really sort of support a pretty basic function for folks. Those are always on the chopping block with this kind of administration.
And some of those have pretty wonky names. I feel like that's why they don't get a ton of love. So like people might know Meals on Wheels. They might not know that, say, the Social Services Block Grant or the Community Development Block Grant are like the sources of federal funds that support these kinds of programs. But that's what you're referring to there.
Yeah. And often they're national programs that disperse funds to community organizations or nonprofits. Sometimes they support food banks or you know, community centers, that kind of thing. So a lot of organizations, nonprofits in towns across America get their, you know, when they hear about the Community Development Block Grant getting cut, that's a huge source of funding for them. It would prevent a ton of really great services that happen across the country.
Yeah, but I interrupted. You were naming programs being eliminated, and there's a lot
more. I know. So depressing. Such a depressing list. Well, so there are all of those programs. There are also, you know, a ton of education. I think it was like 29 education programs, you know, that add up to $6.7 billion in education overall. And that's everything from teacher training to after school programs. And then my personal like wonky interest in this is that there are these things called the regional education labs, which are these like centers that figure out best practices in education. So we're doing all these things that where we require different you know, education or healthcare to be more evidence focused, which is awesome. It's across the aisle, people always are saying like, oh, we should be doing evidence-based policymaking and that kind of thing. But then this budget cuts the agencies that help different organizations become evidence-based. So the regional education labs do all this research about like what are the best practices in teaching, how should you organize curricula. They disseminate that research across the country to teachers or to school districts, but that's what gets cut in a budget like this. Organizations that are trying to help, you know, federal agencies that work across districts or across states to improve practices.
And before we actually started taping, you were relating some kind of wonky memory of how this has played out in past budget rounds and maybe what Trump has learned or hasn't learned from some of that. And some of that actually has to do with these education programs.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty ridiculously wonky. So thanks, listeners, for bearing with me.
Here for it.
But yeah, I feel like of any audience, this is it. So last year, there was the Trump budget proposed combining three different programs. It was the regional education labs that I was talking about, as well as like a data system and the comprehensive centers, which are, they basically help implement K-12 policy. And So the budget proposed combining these, and there was this huge outcry in the education community because it makes no sense to combine these different programs. They have different goals. They're funded in different ways. They're under different parts of the Department of Education. It was just really silly. And so there was this outcry. People pushed back. So this year, the solution that the Trump administration came up with was just cutting all three programs. Like, rather than combine them, like, let's just get rid of them. So it's sort of frustrating to be like, well, I guess you learned that, you know, people were going to push back against that policy choice of combining them, but you learned in the wrong direction.
Which is such a through line, I think, you know, across the board. I mean, right down to the fact that they even decided to release this budget in two parts, which itself is a learning proof, right? Mm-hmm. They learned that getting slammed on the budget shows that people don't like their policies, but instead of changing the policies, they just changed the rollout structure, right? Mm-hmm. That's literally like what they learned from last year. There's more programs that they eliminated. Seth, what else got eliminated?
I mean, another one is the low-income home energy assistance program, or LIHEAP, right? So this is a program that provides financial support for people to afford, for low-income people to afford home energy assistance, heating in the winter and cooling in the summer. And about 6 or 7 million families across the country rely on this program, and it's entirely eliminated in the Trump budget under the guise of, you know, needing to reduce deficits.
This was one of those programs back when I was still representing clients as a legal aid lawyer, where, like, of all the programs that don't have national name recognition that play such a critical role in people's lives, LIHEAP is like top of that list. We're talking about seniors who otherwise can't afford to heat their homes in the winter or can't afford air conditioning in the summer. Literally, people die every single year by numbers that would shock. That's all the time we had for this interview this week, but you can find the full conversation on the podcast version of Off Kilter anywhere podcasts are found. And that does it for this week's episode of Off Kilter, powered by the Center for American Progress Action Fund. I'm your host, Rebecca Vallis. The show is produced by Will Urquhart and David Ballard. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Off Kilter Show, and you can find us on the airwaves on the Progressive Voices Network and the We Act Radio Network, or anytime as a podcast on iTunes. See you next week.
I want freedom. Freedom. But it's calling me back. I feel my spirit is revealing the mouth. We just trying to get freedom.